A 2021 study across a dozen countries and over 14,000 individuals found that 75% of people feel stuck professionally. 8 out of 10 say they are ready to make a change, but the vast majority feel that they can't because of the obstacles they face. The researchers went all over the world talking to C-suite executives, managers, employees alike, covered ages ranging from 22 to 74. This isn't a slice problem. This is an everybody problem. You ever feel stuck in life? You're not alone. Even the king of Israel felt that way. He tells us so in this book. Now, if you were here a couple weeks ago, we have just set out on a quest for meaning and purpose with this expert guide that Ecclesiastes calls the teacher. This book is the travelogue that he uses to show us what he's found. And what he shows us is some harsh realities. And he challenges us along the way to wrestle with what really matters. We're told at the end that this book is meant to be a pointy stick, a cattle prod that drives us out of complacency into truth, into real understanding, despite how uncomfortable that may be. In these lessons, the teacher speaks to us from the perspective of what we might call, not an atheist, he believes in God, but he speaks to us from the perspective of a humanist or a secularist. One author says, not necessarily denying God's existence, but trying to make sense of life as though God were optional. Someone who doesn't have a real personal relationship with God, who doesn't really interact with God, doesn't commune with God, doesn't consider God a significant part of his life. And what the teacher has discovered is that not only do people feel stuck, which is bad enough, he says, no, you are stuck. In this world, human beings are trapped in a system that ultimately leaves us unfulfilled and forgotten. Buckle up. Tonight's text does not take us along the beautiful Pacific Coast Highway. This route is a drive through the Nevada desert, and the gas gauge is on empty. The scenery is not great, and the company is a little bit worse, at least tonight. So we begin in verse 2. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility. Everything is futile. So we covered this verse last time in our opening because this is the most important place to start when you're studying Ecclesiastes. You need to do two things. Number one, understand what he means in this opening line. And then number two, read the last page of the book. So we covered this last time, but we do want to once again hear the opening of the teacher's speech. And we should remind ourselves of what he means. Futility, or your Bible may have vanity or meaningless, is the Hebrew word hevel. And it is the most important word in this book. It refers literally to a puff of smoke. And as a puff of smoke, it could, have different sort of shades of meaning depending on what he is labeling as hevel. A puff of smoke could be something that is toxic as we breathe it, something that is just uncontrollable, something that's absurd, something that's here for a time and then disappears. We need to not just have one sort of catch-all definition when we see this word hevel. You can't grab smoke. You can't build with it or build on it. It's there, but you can't hold on to it. It's hevel. It's smoke. The teacher isn't just a pessimist. It's not just that he's the Bible's Eeyore and you're like, the teacher, he's always sees the bad side of things. No, through these chapters, we're going to discover that this individual, he is the expert of the Bible. He knows more than us. He has experienced more than us. He has considered more than us. Way more. Derek Kidner rightly notes that Solomon, who is the author and the teacher of Ecclesiastes, Solomon was the most brilliant and the least limited of men. And so we saw last time that Ecclesiastes comes to us, and at the beginning there is the author of Ecclesiastes, who's Solomon, speaking, and he introduces us to the teacher. And he says, hey, you guys should all listen to the teacher. He's the foremost expert in the world. You really need to hear what he has to say. It's just that he's also the teacher. And so he is the most brilliant, least limited of men. And he goes down every avenue of life that a person can go down. And he goes down to the fullest extent, way more than any one of us could individually go down. And he says, I went to the end of the road of that avenue of life, of that avenue of life, of that avenue of life. Let me tell you what the destination at the end is. And right up front here, he tells us sort of the bottom line up front. Everything is hevel. In the Hebrew, hevel is the first word of the teacher's lecture and the last word. It's the bookends of everything that he's going to say in these 12 chapters. He uses it 38 times in 12 chapters. He keeps hammering it home. Verse 3, what does a person gain for all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? If the teacher stopped by to pick you up for this route through life, and he visited you at your job or in your classroom or while you were mowing the lawn, he might say, what are you working on there? And you'd show him the sale you just closed, the client you just signed, the paper you just finished after an all-night edit, the sprinkler system you finally got working just right, right? And then he'd say, does any of that matter? And he says, and spoiler alert, no, I don't think any of that matters. Oh, wow. And he says, how is that going to help you when you die? Like, man, hey, man, I'm just trying to keep my lawn from dying. And he says, how is that going to help you? You see, after conducting all of his research, the teacher discovered three really major problems that plague every human life. And those three problems are time, death, and chance. No one escapes them. Time, death, and chance. That's the world we live in. It is plagued by those three enemies. The teacher says that in the end, one day, you are going to die. And on that day, the businesses you built, the degrees you earned, the awards you won, the relationships you maintained, the milestones you reached, none of those things are going to profit you as you lie in your casket. The pharaohs, they were buried with their treasure, right? Famously in the pyramids. But we all know the treasure no longer belonged to them. It belonged to the sand. And then later to the archaeologists who came and broke in and helped themselves to it. Didn't belong to the pharaohs anymore. Every now and then you'll hear a story about someone like Sandra West, the San Antonio socialite who was buried in her Ferrari, right? She's trying to take it with her. But we all know that car will never drive again. No matter what we attain for ourselves, aggregate, accomplish in this life, none of it can profit us. That's a word that he uses a bunch of times, the teacher. It's a word that means that which is left over, the net gain. When all is said and done, what's left for you to hold? And he's going to use it 10 times in this book. He's obsessed with finding a profitable life. He's looking for advantage. He's looking for a net positive. He's looking for a reason why life matters, right? The meaning of life. This is the big question that human beings have. What's the meaning of life? And really what we're asking is, what is the net positive, the profit, the advantage of living the life that we're living? And the teacher in Ecclesiastes is the only Old Testament writer who uses this particular word. But he talks a lot about it. He's also the only one to use the phrase under the sun. So hevel's used 38 times in the book, prophet used 10 times in the book, under the sun 29 times in this book. And again, we talked about this last time. This phrase, under the sun, cracks the code of Ecclesiastes. It reveals to us why he's saying the things that he's saying, because when you first read through Ecclesiastes, you're shocked and maybe scandalized by some of the statements that the teacher makes, and you think, what is going on here? How could a writer of scripture say some of the things that he's saying? But this is the code. This is the rubric that he's using. Under the sun. That's the field of study. That's the map on the table that he is pointing out to us. The teacher is talking about the mortal human experience disconnected from eternity. We know that eternity is real, but he's speaking from this perspective, under the sun, the life that we're in these mortal bodies, looking around at this temporal world, under the sun. And what he says is, under the sun, life is hevel, and he's going to prove it to us over and over and over again. He says, we are trapped in an absurd, meaningless, transient haze. And to prove this thesis, he's going to begin by drawing our attention to the natural world. Look at verse 4. It says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Okay, so it's not just that time passes. The language there, scholars will tell you that, no, he's specifically saying generations die, generations are born and then they die. He wants to draw our attention to death. Time and death have partnered together in this world. Generations die. Another one is born, takes the place of the previous one, time passes, and then they die too. The earth remains forever. That makes us scratch our heads. On the one hand, a non-believing evolutionary, you know, someone who believes in evolution might say, well, we know that eventually the sun's going to run out of fuel in a couple billion years, and that'll be that. So the earth won't last forever. All the way on the other side of things, a Bible-believing Christian would say, well, we know the earth isn't going to last forever. That's been revealed in lots of places in the scripture. So what's this about? What's he saying? The point the teacher wants to get across is that this world is locked into a perpetual cycle that you can't break out of. Linguists explain that what he said there is more like the earth remains as ever, or the world always stays the same. There's never going to be a day when we wake up and the earth decided to spin the other way or not spin at all. No sort of planetary casual Friday, right? It's always going to keep doing what it has always done. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets. Panting, it hurries back to the place where it rises. The average American is going to live just shy of 29,000 days. Begs the question, right? How many sunsets do you have left? That's a interesting question to think about. Unpleasant, but interesting. Of course, the truth is we don't know, because not only are we trapped in a system plagued by time and death, but chance is in the mix too, right? You may have had your last sunrise. That's just the reality of life. It's altogether possible that not everybody makes it to tomorrow. I think the odds are that everybody in the room will. But we all know it's not a sure thing. Chance is in the mix. And if you're not a Christian here tonight, you should think long and hard about that question. How many sunsets, how many sunrises do you have left? Every time our sun completes his little trip across the sky, you've got one less sunrise coming your way. You're going to die one day. I'm going to die one day. And guess what? The morning after, sun's still going to rise. And the morning after that, the sun will rise again. That's the cycle. That's the system. That's what the teacher's pointing out. Verse 6 says, gusting to the south, turning to the north, turning, turning goes the wind, and the wind returns in its cycles. Solomon really was an ingenious discoverer. It seems that he knew something of the circular jet streams of the wind. In one part of the world, the wind blows from the north to the south, and another part east to west. And the idea is we're meant to notice the monotonous, seemingly purposelessness of these activities. We can chuckle about how even when we think as human beings we have figured out how to harness the force like the wind, right? We figured it out. We have technology, we have ingenuity, we have know-how, we have science. Guess what? We can harness the power of the wind. We've cracked the code. It still can end up being a big pile of hevel. CNN published a story last year whose headline began like this: wind energy has a massive waste problem. Another report pointed out that hundreds of thousands of birds are killed by wind turbines every single year. And so just when we think we've fixed things or even improved things or we've done something that is going to better the situation, we think we've solved the problem, we just create a few more. Why? It's hevel. Because life under the sun is hevel, chasing the wind. Verse 7, all the streams flow to the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. I have a really bad habit of starting to fill a water pitcher on the kitchen counter and then turning to go do something else, thinking, well, I'll be back in time. And then 5 minutes later, I realize I've forgotten all about the pitcher and now I have a pool in my kitchen, right? I do that way more often than I should. I need to figure something out to not do that anymore. But, you know, not so the oceans. Of course, we understand, well, there's evaporation and those sorts of things, but the oceans, they're never full, right? They never overfill in the sense of a pitcher overfilling and be like, hey, we got to turn off the rivers and the tributaries. We got to do all that because the oceans are full. Israel's famous Dead Sea. It's landlocked, no outlet. And yet, every day, all day, for thousands and thousands of years, the Jordan River has flowed into the Dead Sea. But guess what? It's never full. It's never done. The cycle never ends. Verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than anyone can say. The eye is not satisfied by seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. I'm sure many of you have a favorite piece of music. More than a favorite, a piece that moves you or arrests your attention, that really impacts your heart, and you think, wow, listen to that. Maybe you've even heard it performed live at decibels so loud that your head was humming afterward. But then what happens after hearing it, that magnificent, masterpiece, you're not done hearing music. It's just, well, what's next? What's next on the album? What's next in the queue? What's the next song? We always want to hear more. There's never a time where we thought, oh, we've heard enough and we're done hearing. You might find yourself saying at some point, I've seen enough. But that doesn't really mean you don't want to see anymore. You just want to see something else. It's that what you're looking at here is unpleasant. I've seen enough of that. Please show me something else. The eye is never full. The ear is never full. The human experience is never done. And that's because the human experience, according to the teacher, at least under the sun, is wearisome. We're worn out like old Mr. Sun panting across the sky. Oh, sure, some people are more cheery about the human experience than others. But tell anybody in this room that it's once again time for their dental checkup, or it's once again time to go renew your license. Oh, man, take the dentist 7 days a week, twice on Sunday, rather than go down to the DMV. Tell anybody that, hey, the cycle is back. It's time to renew your license. It's time to get your teeth all poked with that weird hooky thing that they use. Man, we'll all start feeling and sounding like the teacher in no time, right? A person may distract themselves from the realities of the sort of repetitive monotony cycle of life, but we cannot deliver ourselves from the realities of this world, from the hardships, from the unfairness, those goals you couldn't quite reach, from time, death, and chance. You hear about these strange things that the uber wealthy do to try to extend life or to try to beat death or try to roll back the effects of time. And they may have some success in some small area of, keeping some aspect of their body or their mind a little sharper than the rest of ours for a few more years. But we all know that you can't beat time, death, and chance. As we consider these things, though, we realize that this is a human problem. The sun isn't depressed about its job, boring as it is. Did you know that Western lowland gorillas almost never sleep in the same bed twice, that they make a new nest bed every single day? But no gorilla is out there going, oh, this again. I have to make a bed again? I had plans. I was going to do this. I was going to go out for the gorilla baseball team, but instead I'm making a bed, Isn't there something more? All the kids' movies are about that, where we take, lovable, cuddly-looking animals, but we anthropomorphize them and give them the human desires, the human problems, the human desires for more. No real little clownfish is out there wishing it could get, out and touch the boat. That's a human problem. That's a human desire. Humans are different. We are restless. We feel unfulfilled, stuck, frustrated with the workings of life. And the teacher speaks for us, looking around. He says, the earth remains, but I don't remain. Why is that? But why do we think that? Why do we wonder why our lives have frustration, but the gorilla's life, he's not frustrated. He's not upset. He's not depressed. Without being too irreverent, there's no gorilla suicides, right? Right? The animals don't kill themselves because they're depressed or because life hasn't worked out or because of the hardships that they face. You see some of these animals, they're like climbing, they fall out of the tree, and they're like, oh, I guess I fell out of the tree. I'll just climb up again. Nobody's upset. So what's going on with humanity? Meanwhile, humans are working and striving and struggling just to make ends meet and try to make it to the end. And what happens at the end? You die and you get nothing for it. The system we're in doesn't seem to match up with the hopes and the aspirations and the needs that we have in the deepest part of our hearts. It doesn't seem to match what human beings are made for. Why is that? Why are we so different, so distinct, so separate, and so disappointed in comparison to all the other living things on planet Earth? Verse 9, we're not done on our desert road trip here. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Can one say about anything, look, this is new? It has already existed in the ages before us. Wait, I have an iPhone, right? Solomon never had an iPhone. No, but he's not talking about tools. He's not talking about devices and gadgets. He may not have had an iPhone, but he had other means of communication, other means of entertainment, other means of distraction. Even the laws of physics back up what the teacher is saying in these verses. The law of the conservation of mass says that matter cannot be created or destroyed, right? The atoms that comprise our universe are fixed. And by the way, that's a significant blow to the secular theory of the Big Bang, right? That there was nothing and then suddenly there were all the everything. But in the everything, we've discovered this law that matter cannot be destroyed or created. What's going on, right? And so it's funny because in that sense, it's like, well, I have an iPhone and Solomon didn't have one. Yeah, but in some strange sense, you might be holding some of the elements that Solomon had as a tablet, and then it was changed through chemical processes. It's like Pigpen, right? That it's the dust of ancient Babylon, right, that he's dealing with. But there's nothing new. Devices may be new, but the problems of life are the same. The pursuits of life are the same. Every generation that has ever lived has struggled to break free of the chains of time, death, and chance, but we can't do it. We've tried inventions. We've tried different kinds of societies. We've tried all sorts of cultures with all sorts of values. The cycle is always the same. Nothing new. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of those who came before, and of those who will come after, there will also be no remembrance by those who follow them. At work or at school, there was someone who sat at your desk before you, and there'll be someone sitting there after you. You may put your mark on your company or your community or your classroom, but given enough time, one day you will be thought of for the last time by other human beings. That's what the teacher says from his secular, ground-level perspective, life under the sun. And that's an unpleasant thing to think about, but under the sun, that is absolutely true. Someone might protest, well, no, some people are remembered. What about Alexander the Great? What about Hammurabi? What about Shakespeare? Okay, we still remember their names, though it profits those individuals nothing. They're dead and are going to remain dead as far as this world is concerned. Give it time. Shakespeare will be forgotten, right? If you're a secularist who doesn't, you know, buy into what the Bible says about the unfolding plan of redemption and the unfolding plan of human history, and you just think the world is going to just keep going, well then give it a few thousand years, a few hundred thousand years or whatever, and everyone is going to be forgotten. I mean, think about this. Who among us can name one of the great Incan emperors? Well, I don't care about them. Okay, yeah, that's right. Who can name California's first senators? Who can name the only three runners in human history who have won 2 gold medals for the marathon? I looked it up and I still can't remember them, right? Let's get real. Can you name your own great-great-great-grandmother, any of them? No. Well, I've forgotten them because I've never heard about them. And so this is what the teacher's talking about. Physical accomplishment or attainment or accumulation are not enough, not for the human heart. Legacy is not enough. We have a need for something more. Why do we care about the meaning of life? Why do people feel stuck and unfulfilled? Why is there such a difference, like we talked about before, a difference, you know, the secularist says, well, gorillas and human beings, we're all just primates. Why is there such a difference in the felt experience, in the aspirations, in the needs? When we make movies, why do we need to anthropomorphize the little creatures to make them more like us? And the difference is because the teacher explains that God has placed eternity in your heart. That's the difference. This life, this world, with its perpetual cycle, cannot ultimately satisfy. We yearn to break out of the cycle of repetition and disappointment and hevel. We long for something new. If you're not a Christian, You may not feel the weight of this reality tonight, but it is true all the same. And the teacher and I, speaking with the teacher tonight, I would urge you to sit and think with these dark thoughts for the night, because they are true. That yearning lurks in your heart. You may distract yourself. You may try to cover over it. You may try to medicate yourself out of it. You may have convinced yourself that, well, once I die, it's all over, but it's not true. There's something in your heart that yearns for more, that needs more. We long for something new. Some are brave enough to say the quiet part out loud. Pink Floyd saying, "So you run and you run to catch up with the sun, but it's sinking, racing around to come up behind you again. The sun is the same in a relative way, but you're older, shorter of breath, and one day closer to death." It's the greatest album of all time. Yeah. Nothing new. They're just saying what the teacher said. Or maybe you're more of a U2 fan, right? You've got to get yourself together. You've been stuck in a moment, and now you can't get out of it. Don't say that later will be better. You're stuck in a moment, and you can't get out of it. This is the inkling of the human heart. Saying, what do we say? Like, they're saying the quiet part out loud. Those same respondents who said they felt stuck at work from the beginning of our study, 75% of them, they're so desperate, feel so stuck, so unfulfilled, 75% of those people said they'd be willing to make life changes based off of robot recommendations. They're just desperate to break free, desperate for something new, desperate for answers. But we can't break free. We can't find the answers under the sun. We're looking for meaning. We're looking for a reason. We're looking for help. We desperately need to be saved out of the hevel of life. But we can't. And so God broke into our system. Jesus Christ said, "I will come down from heaven above the sun, and I will come down under the sun, and I will show another way." In some ways, he spoke a lot like the teacher. Surprising, but he really did. Think about it. He once asked a very Ecclesiastes-like question. He said, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul?" Cutting right through to the fact that, hey, you can argue that, well, we're just, you know, evolved from animals and nothing happens after you die. But in our heart of hearts, we know it's not true, because there is that eternity planted there by our Creator who loves us. What? And he asked this question. But where the teacher came to the conclusion that everything is hevel, Jesus said, "Yeah, but I have door number two." And he offers us a way out. A way out of the chains of time, death, and chance. Out of a life where nothing ultimately matters, into a life where everything matters. Even the smallest activity, he says, matters. You can get a little cup of water and hand it to somebody, he says, and I, if you walk with me, will make that eternally matter. I will make that have value that you could never make have value. He makes us new creation. So the teacher says, "Man, under this sun is nothing new." And Jesus says, "That's right. So I will come down, break into your system, show you door number two, where you can rise above the concerns of this world, and you are going to be made new. You will be the new thing." And he says, "You're going to be a new creation, and I'm going to establish a new covenant with you." And he gives us a new heart and new songs to sing so that we can walk in newness of life. In the end, he will bring us to live in a new heaven and a new earth. This earth, with all of its trouble, will pass away, and all things will be made new. Those are all promises of the newness when we walk with Jesus Christ. This world that the teacher is examining is not the reason for living. This world is only here so that God can have a backdrop to reveal his love to people and to offer them real life with real purpose and meaning, a life that lasts forever, a life that isn't forgotten by time, a life that isn't swallowed up by death, a life that isn't ruined by chance. Door number two, a way through the hevel of this world into the purpose and value and meaning of eternity. And as we walk in newness of life, God tells his people, Christians, okay, your mind now is going to be set on things above, not on things of the earth. You live in this world, but you're not defined by this world. You're not trapped by this world. You're not bounded by this world. And that's why a guy like Paul could be singing praises in a dungeon after being beaten within an inch of his life. He says, I have discovered, I have learned how to be content. I have discovered what I need to have the joy, the peace, the eternal benefits of walking with God. Now life is no longer heaven, not for the Christian. Now for the unbeliever, nothing matters. The teacher is going to prove it from every perspective. For the Christian, everything we do matters. Everything. Every experience, every circumstance, every situation, every single thing we do every single day can have eternal weight because it is done unto the Lord. And it is part of His unfolding plan in our lives. And He says, your labor is no longer in vain. Your labor now is profitable. Your future is secure, your purpose fulfilled, because God Himself walks with you on this new path to make something new out of your life so that in the end, you will live in newness in eternity. This is the exchange offered to us through Christ. Freedom, help, answers, a future, grace for today, hope for tomorrow. More than a legacy, He offers eternity, one filled with rest, and joy, and rewards, and glory. And most of us, I think, are Christians here tonight. And we need to remember, oh, okay, this is not just about being cleansed from sin. That is obviously the most important first step of a relationship with God. That, okay, He has taken the guilt of my sin away, but we need to understand that, okay, but with salvation comes so much more. The freeing from the chains of time, death, and chance. The installation of a newness of life where everything we do has purpose. The smallest action, the biggest achievement. He's like, this has purpose now. Whereas outside of a relationship with me, none of it matters. It doesn't matter if you've scaled the tallest mountain, accumulated all the wealth, none of it matters. You're all just trapped in the hevel of life. But if you walk with me, we walk in newness of life. On a new path that leads to a new destination, the new heaven and the new earth, and you are made new along the way. What a great exchange that the Lord offers to us and shows us how to walk and then empowers us to walk with Him. We don't do it perfectly. We get bogged down by the stresses of life, by the frustrations of life, by time, death, and chance. The Lord reminds us through Ecclesiastes, there is something more. There is something new. There is a life above, and we get to set our minds on those things.